Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life. This is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Michael Ferrugia, who is a founding partner of the law firm of Ferrugia and Callisto. Mike, how are you today?
I'm great, John. Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, I'm so happy you're back. Actually, before we start talking about the financial aspects of a real estate transaction, one of the things you started or founded also is the New York Center of Real Estate, which is called NYCOR. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. NYCOR is the New York, as you said, is the New York Center of Real Estate, and that's our real estate school where we conduct continuing education courses for licensed real estate agents. Real estate agents need to keep up with their continuing education credits, and that's what we help them do by bringing them real-world experience and practice tips to right. the classroom.
Well, the thing that I had taken one of the courses you had offered was on TRID, which I found really informative.
Great, thank you.
And educational, so I appreciate that. So, okay, let's talk about the financial aspects of the real estate transaction. How do you address them in the contract of sale?
Well, every real estate contract must address not only what the contract deposit will be that the purchaser is going to tender, but also whether or not the remaining balance is going to be financed. In doing so, what often happens is there's a confusion of a very loosely used term, the down payment. That's used very loosely and quite frankly interchangeably sometimes with the contract deposit. The contract deposit, for clarification, is what the purchaser puts down on contract, that check that they put down to guarantee that they comply with the terms.
And what percentage is that, by the way?
It could be any percent. It is up for negotiation. The traditional amount is usually 10% on contract.
Oh, so it can be negotiated. It
absolutely can be negotiated.
So it's not written in stone.
There's no laws. Whatever the seller will be willing to accept.
Okay.
So under that scenario, if the purchaser puts down 10% on contract, that may not be their down payment amount. Under a traditional deal, again, it's traditionally 10% on contract and then another 10% at closing, leaving 80% to be financed. So while the quote-unquote down payment amount would be a total of 20%, it would only be a 10% check cut upon contract signing.
Okay. So why is it important to address this, the balance of the purchase price that's being financed?
It's extremely important if it is a requirement for the purchaser. In other words, if a purchaser does require traditional financing, mortgage financing, to complete the purchase of the price, it's imperative for them to incorporate what's called a mortgage contingency clause within the contract of sale. And what that clause does is it basically is a disclosure that the purchaser's obligations to purchase this home is contingent upon their ability to procure financing. And if there are any hiccups or if they are, for whatever reason, unable to obtain that financing, then they would not forfeit their contract deposit.
Do you ever recommend somebody not putting in a mortgage contingency?
Well, if it is a requirement for our purchaser, then they have to have that clause in the contract. So if they do not have 100% liquid funds, then they must have a mortgage contingency in that contract to protect them. If they would be unable to obtain that financing, they would not forfeit any monies, as long as that inability was not due to any fault of their own.
Understood. So what are several reasons why a seller might object to a contingency clause?
Well, plainly, it creates an unknown. The purchaser has a potential out if they're, for whatever reason, unable to get their financing. And if they avail themselves of that out, that would then in turn translate to a loss of marketing time for that seller. And if you're in a very seasonal area, as we are out here in the East End, that marketing time could be very, very valuable. In addition to that, by incorporating a mortgage contingency clause, that in turn requires a satisfactory appraisal by the lender. And all these things also take time. So to have mortgage financing incorporated into a transaction does draw out the timeline substantially.
So you're saying basically cash is king?
Cash is always king. But that's not to say that mortgage right. contingencies are not uncommon.
Now, that's interesting that you say about with the appraisal. What happens, and I'm sure this has happened to you or you've been involved in transactions where the appraisal comes in below the number to make the transaction happen.
Just because an appraisal comes in short of the purchase price does not necessarily mean that the mortgage amount applied for by the purchaser would be denied. Each transaction is a universe in and of themselves. It all depends on the loan-to-value ratio, how much wiggle room the lender has to play with. But short appraisals do pose a potential problem to the lenders most of the time.
Right. We talked earlier about TRID because the new regulations are that if everything is not dotted and the T's are not crossed, it goes right back to the beginning for the purchaser dealing with the bank. So how would that affect the purchaser if the appraisal came in? Would it all of a sudden just change the time frame for the closing?
It may or may not have any effect whatsoever. It all depends on the deficiency and the shortfall. Again, you have to look at these as a case by case, and if the mortgage applied for was only a 50% mortgage and the appraisal came in 5% short, it is probably not going to affect the lender's ability or willingness to lend. But if the purchaser was applying for 80% financing and it came in 10% short, that certainly would.
So let's talk about the difference between an all-cash offer or versus a non-contingent offer.
Sure. The term all-cash is also a very, very loosely used term in the industry. That there must be a distinction as to a true all-cash transaction, and that is where the purchaser has 100% of the purchase price, plus all of their closing costs in liquid funds of their own here to close. There's no financing involved. That is not to say that they might not entertain a non-contingent contract, and what that means is that although the purchaser may have 100% funds available to close, they are opting to get financing. Although it's not a necessity, they are opting to get financing as a matter of financial planning. And under these circumstances, it creates situations that you really do need to bring the seller into the loop. I am of the opinion that full disclosure is the best way to negotiate a successful contract to sale. In order to successfully close a transaction that has financing, you're going to require the seller's cooperation.
Absolutely. So how can someone partake of your extensive legal knowledge, Mike?
Well, if they are a licensed real estate agent, they're certainly welcome to attend any of our courses offered through NICOR, and there they can find them at NICOR.net. If they'd like to contact me at the firm, they can also visit the law firm's website, fclawfirm.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Mike. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back after this short break with our next guest, Brad Beyer. Hi, this is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I'm here with my guest, Brad Beyer, who is the founder of Beyer to Beyer Home Inspections. Hey, Brad, how are you?
Good morning, John.
No, Brad. I know you had a long day.
Oh, it's good afternoon, John.
It's good afternoon.
Excuse me.
That's quite all right.
That was a big house.
It was a big house you were inspecting. So before we get into home inspections, Brad, I'd like to reminisce a little bit about Sag Harbor Village. You grew up in the village, correct?
I grew up on High Street, yeah, close to the village, yes.
Yeah.
I love Sag Harbor.
That's the village. So what was it like when you were a kid in the village?
It's hard to describe. It was. You think back on it, it was just so wonderful. We had the whole town to ourselves. You could ride a bike all day. You go to the movies for 35 cents. You don't want to get into that whole thing. When I was a kid, everything was cheaper because it's all relative, but everybody knew who you were. Everybody was watching out for you, and you were accountable. If you were going to go break a bottle in the street, some Italian or some Irish lady or some Jewish lady or some Polish lady would put their head out the window and say, "Hey, buy a boy. I tell your father you do that." You go, "Whoa." And you thought about what you did because everybody was watching. So you had your parent, but then you had 500 other parents.
So it was like...
They kept you halfway straight.
Right. It sounds that
way. You know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, but don't you think it still exists?
No.
I mean, why a lot of people come to Sag Harbor?
No, they just
Village.
Want to sue you. You step on my lawn, I sue you.
I see. Right. You cut my tree, I
yeah,
sue you.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different deal. We used to cut through everybody's yard to go to school, and it was nobody cared. Nobody said anything. Good morning. Good morning, Bob. Yeah, because I had three brothers, right. And we all did the same thing. And you just knew everybody's car. You knew what they were doing, and they were accountable to your parents. And my father worked in Bolivar, and he was very accessible. So if you were walking home at 7 o'clock in the morning when you shouldn't have been, you can bet your butt that he got told.
He got told.
Oh, yeah.
So now Bolivar is now the has been converted. Now,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
I've
what
been
do you
in
think?
It.
You've been in it.
Yeah. I haven't been in it since 1966, probably.
You mean when it was?
When my dad was there. He worked in the press room there.
They stopped making
in the 80s, pretty much. He worked there until 69. He was there 30-something years. Hmm. Started 27 cents an hour. Waited 5 years for a nickel raise. Think about that. A nickel
raise
in
5 years.
How
many boys? Three boys?
Four boys.
Four boys.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And somehow, you know, one bathroom, one car. We're not alone. I mean, every kid in town was like that. It was the same deal. You didn't compare what kids got for Christmas because you got something and it was cool. And you shared the football, you shared the shoulder pads with your brother, whatever the way it worked. But the cool thing was going into that boulevard, when your dad went to work, you know, you didn't call your father at work. You nowadays with the phones, we lose so much time in production of American whatever, lost on the social media, and that's, it's all fine. But I'm just saying, when your father went to work, man, he went to work. He said, "Don't call me unless the house burnt down." So I hadn't been in that building since '66, and I did a condo in there last winter. And I started talking about Bolivar, and it was our life. You knew everybody that was there. If your father brought home a truck to move a tree or something, "Dad, where'd you get the truck?" "Oh, I got this from Bitolacci, you know, or somebody." And okay, Bolivar. So I started talking about Bolivar in that home inspection, and the guy said, "Would you like to go see where your dad worked?" I said, "I can't tell you how much I'd like to see that." So that press room where he worked is now a $7 million condo. And
wow.
They walked us through the whole place, and I hadn't seen it in 50 years, and it was beautifully done. And they said they love it when the locals come in because they like to hear the story. So when it came time to get the fee for the inspection, I said, "I'm good." I spent the day with my dad and all his buddies.
So you really felt like you're back
Oh,
there.
I was complete. It was like, okay, I saw all those ghosts from the past, and I grew up right up the hill. I mean, High Street up Risum Street, right at the top of that hill, Mulford Lane. Right. My father walked to work. He walked home for lunch if he could. We walked to school, and we walked back, and we had three meals a day. Somehow we did it, you know.
Well, High Street, I'm only surmising that it probably was named that because it was like, what, the highest
point? It's one of the, you could sleigh ride down that hill as a kid, and there'd be just no cars. You could go right into Bay Street and right down to Cor Maria. Don't get me started.
Okay. So were you around when the Black Buoy and the Sandbar were in existence?
Black Buoy. I was in San Francisco once singing with a college choir. And I was in the men's room and doing what you do in a men's room. And the guy standing next to me heard me say something. And he says, "Oh, you must be from New York." And I said, "Yes, I'm from New York." I didn't even get to say, "But I'm not a New Yorker per se."
I'm a Sag Harbor.
Different being right. Sag, Long Island's being different.
Right.
Before I could even get that out, he goes, "Do you know this place called the Black Buoy?" That's a true story. Even in San Mateo, California.
I know. So the reputation.
Oh.
Wow.
The buoy was incredible. And some of the stories you obviously can't say on the radio, but they had a little bathroom that was maybe 40 inches square. And to make a certain pool shot with the pool table, you had to open the door to the bathroom.
What if somebody's in there?
No, it was the buoy. It's like you just opened the door. And, okay, hi, how you doing? And you made your elbow shot, and you just shut the door. And sometimes if somebody was in there and somebody else had to go, I see a guy in the corner go, what are you doing? It's the buoy.
It's the buoy, right.
Oh, it was
now,
classic.
That used to be a haunt of Paul Newman, right?
Oh, sure. Paul Newman liked his beer. Paul Newman would bring the race cars out. They'd stay at Barron's. And Dan Hill, Dan Gurney, all those guys that drove the Formula cars. And Newman, he wasn't Mr. Hollywood. There's a great book.
He's a down-to-earth?
He is wonderful. There's a great book called Paul and Me, written by David Hotchner. They called him Hotch. And he was the guy that wrote Papa Hemingway, which is a great book about Ernest Hemingway. A.E. Hotchner was his name. And him and Paul, the ones that came up with the salad dressing and all that stuff, with the $200 million donated, whatever it is, to charities and the Over the Hill gang. Newman wasn't into that whole Hollywood scene. He'd rather give me a cigarette, give me a Budweiser, let me talk to these kids. He was great. He was cool.
Wow. That's cool. That's
Sag Harbor it still is a wonderful place. I live in East Hampton. I'm thankful. I have more room than I have, than I could probably have in Sag Harbor for what I paid to do it. And we need room because if we play music and stuff, we want to have people come. And it's right. Just hard to do that in Sag
Harbor.
Well,
that's one of the things.
My brother's there, though. He's up in Mount Misery.
Oh.
Yeah.
But one of the things I wanted to talk about is that, okay, you do the home inspections, but you have, you're a man of many talents.
Well,
that's
questionable.
Depends on which night you hear. Like, for example, you have the music that you do. But another aspect of your creativity is your artwork. That a lot of people aren't aware of.
You started getting back into it after 40 years.
Wow. And you did something for Billy Joel.
I didn't do it. I didn't. Don't say anything yet, John.
Sorry.
I'm working on something.
Oh, you're working on something.
I'm working on a four.
Now, you know Billy, obviously.
Oh, I know who he is. People have told me all my life, oh, you got to go up to him. No. That's the last thing he wants to hear is, hey, man, I wrote these songs. You know what? Well, so have I. I've written 6,000 of them. What do I need yours for? I've always respected people like that space because I just don't want to, oh, God, not this guy. So I did his house. My brother had a boat, and his boat was next to Billy's. And you just bump into we did a couple benefits together years ago when he was in the waterfront school with his kid. And our daughters were sort of the same age. But to say that he would see me and say, oh, hi, Brad, he'd probably see me and say, oh, you're the guy that – I said, everybody looks like you. As a matter of fact, in the drawings that I'm working on, which are made up of lyrics.
Well, here's the thing. We're going to have to come back because we've run out of time.
We have time already?
We're out of time, exactly.
Oh, John, hit the reset button.
Let's let's go back to the future. So how can someone get in touch with you, Brad?
Oh, easy. Best way to get in touch with me is my cell phone, 631-404-2590.
What is that again?
631-404-2590. Because I'm never in that office. I go to listen to the tape, machine, but I'm never there. I used to have 8 people working for me, and now I got me.
Right. Well, you're doing a great job, Brad. And this is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back after the short break with my next guest, founder of Sag Harbor Rum, Jason Lawn. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and I'm so happy to have with me Jason Lawn, who is a drinks business expert. Is that right, Jason?
That's close enough, good enough to get some stories started.
Okay, fantastic. Now, Jason, you've been on the program before, especially we were talking about Sag Harbor Rum, which you started, and you were the founder, correct,
yes.
At the time? So give us an update of where Sag Harbor Rum is today.
So we've been doing Sag Harbor Rum about 4 years now. We actually just brought a bottle here to the studio of our latest batch, which is batch number 11. We're about to put batch number 12 in the bottles.
Now, what does that mean, a batch? I'm not familiar.
Every time we make rum, we age it for about a year and a half. So that group of barrels that we're aging with, we call a batch because we age it with coffee and we age it with ginger along with a few fruits. So, you know, it gives us this real artisanal batch feeling. You know, you get that a lot with different bourbons and different whiskeys. And, you know, we're doing that with this rum. It's very small. You know, we only produce a few thousand bottles a year. So it's something very, you know, local to the East End and very unique. If you haven't tried it, you know, shameless pitch here. I'd recommend going out. And
absolutely. I totally agree with you on that one.
So it's kind of been a real journey, and it, you know, also that's reflected in each batch. You know, they've been different, the coloring's been different, because it really depends on the temperature that the barrels are aging at, how much color is coming out of the barrels. So we've had some light batches, we've had some very dark batches. This batch 11 has actually got a really nice color to it.
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait to sample that. Maybe we should have a sample now. Kyle, what do you think? Yeah, Kyle's nodding his head. I love it. Okay. So tell us again, what was the journey like getting to where you are today? I mean, give us a little background.
So a little background about myself. Studied chemical engineering, did chemistry in grad school, and then got out, worked for a pharmaceutical company, hated it. Kind of got sucked up into the whole internet thing when it was exploding in the late 90s. And after getting fired from a .com, I started.
You started the .com?
No, I had a .com company. That's, you know, what we called it back in, you know, the 90s. I got fired from it, and I'm half Dutch, and I just wanted to get out of the country. So I moved to Holland. And when I was living over there, I got started to work with a bottle manufacturer, randomly enough. And they introduced me to a lot of, they'd been making like the Kettle One bottle for 400 years. And they were like, oh, why don't you have a background in engineering. Why don't you start working with these guys? And as a result of that, kind of got my foot into the drinks industry. And they were like, they gave us a little vodka brand, me and a good friend, who we had actually, we had a little bar at the time together. And they said, you know, go out and see what you can do with this. And we had a lot of fun with it, probably too much fun. Probably got a little too high on our own supply at the time. But it was a really interesting experience. And then a few years ago, you know, I grew up out here, out east, actually here in Southampton, and came back, now live in Sag Harbor. And I was like, what is something I could do here out on Long Island that ties in, you know, a lot of the, you know, the various industries that, you know, people feel, which, you know, we see a lot of wineries. Now we're seeing an explosion in breweries. And I was like, oh, there's not really any distilleries out here. So, you know, got involved in that. And then as a result, I've gotten really into like doing various drinks out here on the East End. So as a result, I've done a beer, I've done a cider, I've done some wines, done some teas. You know, me and my girlfriend make it's a cold brew workout tea, to, you know. Wow. She's a fitness instructor. And
so it has no alcohol in it?
No alcohol. It's just, you know, just before you go work out, you know, you throw a tea bag in your workout bottle.
Wow. And that's it? And you're energized?
It takes a few minutes to cold brew. And, you know, it's got, you know, all the vitamins and stuff you need, you know, and then some tea supplements to really help it, you know, give yourself a great workout. So it's just been, you know, there's a lot of these micro businesses out here. You know, how do you make a living? You know, living on the East End of Long Island when, you know, all the industry has gone away. And we've seen some people successful at it. You know, I've had a varying degrees of success, and the rum has done well, but like the beer we were doing with a few friends, it was called Clam Rake. The distributor failed to pick it up again this year because.
Oh, geez.
So it was a kind of a bummer.
But yeah, of course.
It was a partnership we had done with a big distributor out East. And that's a whole 2-hour story unto itself. And the cider we did was like really more for the farmers markets. It was ginger and cayenne pepper, you know, and we used
ginger and cayenne.
Yeah, it was called Furnace. It was it did not have the appeal. I loved it, and a few of my friends loved it, but it never really had the appeal to continue with it. So we did it for about 4 years.
Yeah, but isn't there like a drink? What the heck's that? Not Red Bull, I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of another one that has alcohol in it.
Well, there's Fireball.
Fireball, that's
Fireball's it. Like cinnamon, yes. But this was like drinking red pepper with a lot of ginger and lime. And
wow.
I mean, it was delicious.
So not many people like...
They didn't like it. It was shocked. You know, a lot of people would take a sip and they would start...
and their throat would get...
like. So, you know, it was fun, you know, doing the farmers markets with that, you know... really enjoy that. You know, it's a lot of work. You got to get up and you're basically a glorified, you know, schlepper, right. You know, and then
let me just ask a question. Do you do like a tasting, like to go out before you start to get involved in a project? Do you say, okay, let me, like, I know you did vodkas too. Are you still doing vodkas?
I'm not doing a vodka currently.
Okay.
I mean, I'm involved in one that I'm helping some friends. It's completely over in Holland. Mm-hmm. still. But yeah, you try to taste it with friends, but at a certain point you can't crowdsource an idea. You've got to go like, I like this.
I'm going for it.
I trust my own judgment. A lot of times it's wrong, but you know, you got to like step out on the edge of a cliff, so to sort of jump off, because otherwise you just end up with mediocrity.
Right. So tell us, now you've had the success with Sag Harbor Rum, and you're saying about some of the failures. Did you learn anything from some of the things that you didn't succeed on?
Well, you know, there's that expression, men like to say experience is another word for failure. So I've had a lot of experience. I mean, I enjoy the process, and I think that's what you have to do. You try to think that you learn from it, and it's easy in retrospect to go, oh, that was the problem. So like the beer, for instance, that was a project with a distributor on Long Island that distributes Anheuser-Busch products. And what Anheuser-Busch has been doing is kind of going around and buying all these microbreweries. So all of a sudden, now they want this local distributor to sell all these microbreweries from around the United States. So that brewery's like, we got to cut down on everything we sell to accommodate all these products that you know, AB is pushing on us.
Right.
So, you know, there it was a case of like, should have been a little more looked at the macro trends of what's going on with what started. But you also, on the other hand, you see breweries like Montauk doing incredibly well. You know, they set up, made a product, they created, you know, a brand identity that was immediately resonant, and you know, they jumped from doing a few thousand cases to, you know, the word on the street is they did about 500,000.
Wow.
They call it CE's, case equivalents, last year. Huh. I don't know if that's accurate. That's just what the scuttlebutt is.
Right, exactly. That is fascinating. So it's not a case. The ideal situation would be to be bought by AB.
It depends what you want to do. I mean, I personally, the projects I've done, I wouldn't want to do that, because you watch what happens when you get acquired by these big companies. It's not your business anymore. Usually as part of the terms, and I've had this happen to me on the technology side, is they set unrealistic goals and you're not aware that it's not your company anymore, and they manage it in a way that you don't get the payouts you expect.
Right.
And I've seen that happen a lot. Like a friend that worked at this juice company called Blueprint and got bought by Hansen. And they were all excited because they were like, oh, wow, you know, successful cold pressed juice, we're going to do really, really well. And they just never got their payouts because, you know,
it didn't happen.
It just didn't happen, you know, and that happens.
So even having a large company behind you, it doesn't necessarily mean you're there.
The brand does well, but you don't get like the payout unless you're incredibly savvy. I mean, that's why, you know, there's this expression in, you know, smart money. It's like, I always recommend to people, like, if you see you're going to be successful, bring on investors, not so much for the money, but so that they can guide you through that acquisition process.
Speaking of investors, how can they reach you if somebody wants to invest with you? Because it sounds like you have the experience. You've gone through enough things right now that...
Well, to be honest, I've been very hesitant about when I first started, like Sag Harbor Rum, just because I've been through this on the technology side, I've been very hesitant to take on investors. Like, this was a passion project. You know, if someone wants to reach me to talk about the rum, it's just jason@sagharborrum.com.
Great. And where can we get the Batch 11?
Batch 11 is at almost every store on the East End of Long Island. I think I'm missing about two or three liquor stores, but if they don't have it, they'll usually bring it in. So
great.
It's in about 90 places out of here.
Jason Lawn, it's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.